Part 3, Chapter 31. 5 years and 2 months after Lester Clump Sr. and Lester Clump Jr. first set foot in the Hokut house, they finished the renovation. The ordeal was over, and the results were splendid. Once I accepted their languid pace, I settled in for the long haul and worked hard selling ad copy. Twice during the last year of the project, I had unwisely attempted to live in the house and somehow exist in the midst of the debris. In doing so, I had little trouble with the dust, the paint fumes, the blocked hallways, the erratic electricity and hot water, and the absence of heating and air conditioning, but I could never adapt to the early morning hammers and handsaws. They were not early birds, which, as I learned, was unusual for contractors, but they did start in earnest each morning by 8:30. I really enjoyed sleeping until 10. The arrangement didn't work, and after each attempt to live in the big house, I sneaked back across the gravel drive and returned to the apartment, where things were somewhat quieter. Only once in 5 years was I unable to pay the Clumps on time. I refused to borrow money for the project, though Stan at Cavage was always ready to loan it. After work each Friday, I would sit down with Lester Sr., usually on a makeshift plywood table in a hallway, and over a cold beer we would tally up the labor and materials for the week, add 10%, and I would write him a check. I filed his records away, and for the first 2 years kept a running total of the cost of the renovation. After 2 years, though, I stopped adding the weekly to the cumulative. I didn't want to know what it was costing. I was broke, but I didn't care. The money pit had been sealed off. I had teetered on the brink of insolvency, dodged it, and now I could begin stashing it away again. And I had something magnificent to show for the time, effort, and investment. The house had been built around 1900 by Dr. Miles Hokut. It had a distinctive Victorian style, with two high-gabled roofs in the front, a turret that ran up four levels, and wide covered porches that swept around the house on both sides. Over the years, the Hokuts had painted the house blue and yellow, and Mr. Clump Sr. had even found an area of bright red under three coats of newer paint. I played it safe and stayed with white and beige and light brown trim. The roof was copper. Outside, it was a rather plain Victorian, but I would have years to jazz it up. Inside, the heart pine floors on all three levels had been restored to their original beauty. Walls had been removed, rooms and hallways opened up. The Clumps had finally been forced to remove the entire kitchen and build another from the basement up. The fireplace in the living room had actually collapsed under the pressure of relentless jackhammering. I turned the library into a den and knocked out more walls, so that upon entering the front foyer, you could see through the den to the kitchen in the distance. I added windows everywhere. The house had originally been built like a cave. Mr. Clump admitted he had never tasted champagne, but he happily chugged it down as we completed our little ceremony on a side porch. I handed him what I hoped would be his last check. We shook hands, posed for a photograph by Wiley Meek, then popped the cork. Many of the rooms were bare. It would take years to properly decorate the place, and it would require the assistance of someone with far more knowledge and taste than I possessed. Half empty, though, the house was still spectacular. It needed a party. I borrowed $2,000 from Stan and ordered wine and champagne from Memphis. I found a suitable caterer from Tupelo, the only one in Clanton specialized in ribs and catfish, and I wanted something a bit classier. The official invitation list of 300 included everybody I knew in town, and a few I did not. The unofficial list was comprised of those who had heard me say, "We'll have a huge party when it's finished." I invited Bibi and three of her friends from Memphis. I invited my father, but he was too worried about inflation and the bond market. I invited Miss Callie and Esau, Reverend Thurston Small, Claude, three clerks from the courthouse, two school teachers, an assistant basketball coach, a teller at the bank, and the newest lawyer in town. That made a total of 12 blacks, and I would have invited more if I had known more. I was determined to have the first integrated party in Clanton. Harry Rex brought moonshine and a large platter of chitlins that almost broke up the festivities. Bubba Crockett and the Foxhole Gang arrived stoned and ready to party. Mr. Mitlow wore the only tuxedo. Piston made an appearance and was seen leaving through the back door with a carry-out bag filled with rather expensive finger food. Woody Gates and the Country Boys played for hours on a side porch. The Clumps were there with all their laborers. It was a fine moment for them, and I made sure they got all the credit. Lucian Wilbanks arrived late and was soon in a heated argument about politics with Senator Theo Morton, whose wife Rexella told me it was the grandest party she had seen in Clanton in 20 years. Our new sheriff, Trice McNatt, dropped by with several of his uniformed deputies. T.R. Meredith had died of colon cancer the year before. One of my favorites, Judge Reuben V. Attlee, held court in the den with colorful stories about Dr. Miles Hocutt. Reverend Millard Stark of the First Baptist Church stayed only 10 minutes and left quietly when he realized alcohol was being served. Reverend Cargrove of the First Presbyterian Church was seen drinking champagne and appeared to have a taste for it. Baggy passed out in a second-floor bedroom, where I found him the next afternoon. The Stooks twins, who owned the hardware store, showed up in brand-new matching overalls. They were 70 years old, lived together, never married, and wore matching overalls every day. There was no dress requirement. The invitation said, "Open attire." The front lawn was covered with two large white tents, and at times the crowd spilled from under them. The party began at 1 p.m. Saturday afternoon and would have gone past midnight if the wine and food had lasted. By 10, Woody Gates and his band were exhausted. There was nothing left to drink but a few warm beers, nothing to eat but a few tortilla chips, and nothing left to see. The house had been thoroughly seen and enjoyed. Late the next morning, I scrambled eggs for Bibi and her friends. We sat on the front porch and drank coffee and admired the mess made just hours before. It took me a week to clean up. Through the years in Clanton, I'd heard plenty of horror stories of imprisonment at the state penitentiary at Parchman. It was in sprawling farmland in the Delta, the richest farming region in the state, 2 hours west of Clanton. Living conditions were wretched. Cramped barracks that were suffocating in the summer and frigid in the winter, ghastly food, scant medical care, a slave system, brutal sex, forced labor, sadistic guards, the list was endless and pathetic. When I thought of Danny Padgett, which I did often, I was always comforted by the belief that he was at Parchman getting what he deserved. He was lucky he hadn't been strapped to a chair in a gas chamber. My assumption was wrong. In the late 60s, in an effort to ease the overcrowding at Parchman, the state had built two satellite prisons, or camps as they were known. The plan had been to place 1,000 nonviolent offenders in more civilized confinement. They would obtain job training, even qualify for work release. One such satellite was near the small town of Broomfield, 3 hours south of Clanton. Judge Lupus died in 1972. During the Padgett trial, his stenographer had been a homely young woman named Darla Claybo. She worked for Lupus for a few years and after his death left the area. When she walked into my office late one afternoon in the summer of 1977, I knew I had seen her somewhere in the distant past. Darla introduced herself, and I quickly remembered where I'd seen her. For 5 straight days during the Padgett trial, she had sat below the bench, next to the exhibit table, taking down every word. She was now living in Alabama and had driven 5 hours to tell me something. First, she swore me to absolute secrecy. Her hometown was Broomfield. 2 weeks earlier, she had been visiting her mother when she saw a familiar face walking down the sidewalk around lunchtime. It was Danny Padgett, strolling along with a buddy. She was so startled she tripped on the edge of a curb and almost fell into the street. They walked into a local diner and sat down for lunch. Darla saw them through a window and decided not to go in. There was a chance Padgett might recognize her, though she wasn't sure why that frightened her. The man with him wore the uniform that was common in Broomfield: navy slacks, a short-sleeved white shirt with the words Broomfield Correctional Facility in very small letters over the pocket. He also wore black cowboy boots and no gun whatsoever. She explained that some of the guards who handled the prisoners on work release had the option of carrying a weapon. It was hard to imagine a white man in Mississippi voluntarily declining to carry a gun if given the option, but she suspected that perhaps Danny didn't want his own personal guard to be armed. Danny was wearing white dungarees and a white shirt, possibly issued by the camp. The two enjoyed a long lunch and appeared to be good friends. From her car, Darla watched them leave the diner. She followed from a distance as they took a leisurely stroll for a few blocks until Danny entered a building that housed the regional office of the Mississippi Highway Department. The guard got into a camp vehicle and drove away. The following morning, Darla's mother entered the building under the pretext of filing a complaint about a road in need of repair. She was rudely informed that no such procedure existed, and in the ensuing brouhaha, managed to catch a glimpse of the young man Darla had carefully described. He was holding a clipboard and appeared to be just another useless pencil pusher. Darla's mother had a friend whose son worked as a clerk at the Broomfield camp. He confirmed that Danny Paget had been moved there in the summer of 1974. When she finished with the story, she said, "Are you going to expose him?" I was reeling, but I could already see the story. "I will investigate," I said. "Depends on what I find." "Please do. This ain't right." "It's unbelievable. That little punk should be on death row." "I agree. I did 8 murder trials for Judge Lupus, and that one really sticks with me." "Me too." She swore me to secrecy again and left her address. She wanted a copy of the paper if we did the story. At 6 the next morning, I had no trouble jumping out of bed. Wiley and I drove to Broomfield. Since both the Spitfire and the Mercedes were likely to draw attention in any small town in Mississippi, we took his Ford pickup. We easily found the camp 3 miles out of town. We found the Highway Department office building. At noon, we took our positions along Main Street. Since Paget would certainly recognize either one of us, we faced the challenge of trying to hide on a busy street in a strange town without acting suspicious. Wiley sat low in his truck, camera loaded and ready. I hid behind a newspaper on a bench. There was no sign of him the first day. We drove back to Clanton, then early the next morning left again for Broomfield. At 11:30, a prison vehicle stopped in front of the office building. The guard went inside, collected his prisoner, and they walked to lunch. On July 17, 1977, our front page had 4 large photos: one of Danny walking along the sidewalk sharing a laugh with the guard, one of the office building, one of the gate to the Broomfield camp. My headline howled, "No prison for Paget. He's off at camp." My report began: 4 years after being convicted of the brutal rape and murder of Rhoda Cassilaw and being sentenced to life in the state penitentiary at Parchman, Danny Paget was moved to the state's new satellite camp at Broomfield. After 3 years there, he enjoys all the perks of a well-connected inmate: an office job with the State Highway Department, his own personal guard, and long lunches, cheeseburgers and milkshakes, in local cafes where the other patrons have never heard of him or his crimes. The story was as venomous and slanted as I could possibly make it. I bullied the waitress at the City Grill into telling me that he had just eaten a cheeseburger with French fries, that he ate there 3 times a week, and that he always picked up the check. I made 12 phone calls to the Highway Department until I found a supervisor who knew something about Paget. The supervisor refused to answer questions, and I made him sound like a criminal himself. Penetrating Broomfield camp was just as frustrating. I detailed my efforts and tilted the story so it sounded as though all the bureaucrats were covering up for Paget. No one at Parchman knew a damned thing, or if they did, they were unwilling to talk about it. I call the highway commissioner, an elected official, the warden at Parchman, thankfully an appointed position, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, and finally the governor himself. They were all too busy, of course, so I chatted with their bootlickers and made them sound like morons. Senator Theo Morton appeared to be shocked. He promised to get right to the bottom of it and call me back. At press time, I was still waiting. The reaction in Clanton was mixed. Many of those who called or stopped me on the street were angry and wanted something done. They truly believed that when Padgett had been sentenced to life and led away in handcuffs, that he would spend the rest of his days in hell at Parchman. A few seemed indifferent and wanted to forget Padgett altogether. He was old news. And among some, there was the frustrating, almost cynical lack of surprise. They figured the Pagets had worked their magic once more, found the right pockets, pulled the right strings. Harry Rex was in this camp.
What's the big fuss, boy? They bought governors before.
The photo of Danny walking down the street, free as a bird, frightened Miss Callie considerably.
She didn't sleep last night,
Esau mumbled to me when I arrived for lunch that Thursday.
I wish you hadn't found him.
Fortunately, the Memphis and Jackson newspapers picked up the story, and it took on a life of its own. They turned up the heat to a point where the politicians had to get involved. The governor and the attorney general, along with Senator Morton, were soon jockeying to lead the parade to get the boy sent back to Parchman. 2 weeks after I broke the story, Danny Padgett was reassigned to the state penitentiary. The next day, I received two phone calls, one at the office, one at home while I was asleep. Different voices, but with the same message. I was a dead man. I notified the FBI in Oxford, and two agents visited me in Clanton. I leaked this to a reporter in Memphis, and soon the town knew that I had been threatened and that the FBI was investigating. For a month, Sheriff McNatt kept a patrol car in front of my office around the clock. Another one sat in my driveway during the night. After a 7-year hiatus, I was carrying a gun again.